Hello, good morning. You're very welcome to the program. Between now and nine, wild and woolly hedges in Tip, exotic mushrooms in Offaly, record-breaking gathering of black-faced sheep in Connemara, and a man from the islands with a guitar. Have you been busy plundering the hedges for their autumn bounty, staining your fingers purple with blackberries, gathering elderberries, cobnuts, loes? Or perhaps you're not that kind of person who snacks on fistfuls of wild pea. Are you maybe the kind who curses the hawthorn for puncturing your good football? Or did you once upon a time make pea shooters out of the dried out stem of cow parsley? There is nothing in the Irish landscape that we take more for granted than the hedgerow. There is also nothing that shapes the Irish landscape more than the hedgerow. And while some continue to rip them out at the shocking rate of between 1 and 2,000 kilometres a year to make way for bigger, more productive fields, this week I met two farmers in Tipperary who could not possibly be more enthusiastic about letting the hedges on their farms grow out a bit.
There's just an interesting thing. I reckon that a badger actually dug out that, and that's actually a wasp's nest.
It's not easy to have an uninterrupted chat with Pat Marr as you walk his land. Every few yards, there's something in the hedges that he wants you to have a look at.
Nest. See it?
It is, isn't it? Look at that.
And look at the power that would need it to do that. Now, if I said to me he wanted to be fairly hungry to start interfering with the wasps.
What's a badger going to get out of a wasp's nest?
That's a very good question.
There's no honey in there.
So it's the old stump that has rotted that they found a place.
Literally 20 yards later, he stops me once again to point out one of the few elms anywhere in the country with resistance to Dutch elm disease.
So there might be some resistance in this elm to the fungus that the beetle brings.
So this is the new generation of hopefully successor elms, yeah?
Yes, yeah. I was told for 3 or 4 years ago it would start to die, but it has grown another, I'd say, 10 feet since.
If you had done the orthodox thing with your hedges, that elm wouldn't have had a chance, would it?
Correct, wouldn't have had a chance.
That's something to bear in mind now, isn't
it? It is. We need the hedgerows and we need nature around us. No.
At a time of year when birds are gradually retreating from view, the hedges of Pat's farm are groaning under the weight of so much fruit that there is still a riot of bird life.
It was a mixed farm, and I concentrated more on dairying for the last 30, 40 years. They'll talk about sustainability all the time, but there was no resilience in the system. We thought if we had more production, we'd have more money. But we had more expense as well. So my answer to that was the definition of insanity is doing the same things over and over again and expecting a different result. So I felt I wanted to change. And I did a biodiversity course.
And what prompted you to do that?
I think my wife saw it and said, you might be interested in that.
What was the big thing that you learned?
The mantra, what did you do when you knew? So when you know that you have interfered with nature in some way, or what actually did you do now? What did you do when you knew? Did you just stand idly by and say, well, I can't do anything? But in actual fact, every little journey that you make, every little thing you do, is a positive. Here I've left the hedges grow. You hear even the birds here. This is an October morning where there's a bit of wind, and yet the birds are there. There's plenty of fruit on the...
I was going to say, your hedgerows are, what's the word I'm looking for? Fecund. Abundant with... rows and hips and berries of all kinds.
Yeah, and that's just by leaving them on a tree, maybe the five-year rotation. I feel it's a kind of Victorian, where the Victorians wanted to control everything, and we want the short back and sides, and everything is neat. But it's the divide of everything, and while nature can survive without man can't survive without nature. If we destroy nature, we'll destroy ourselves.
People are beginning to appreciate the many roles and values and contributions of this hedge to all the environmental challenges we're facing.
Such as?
Well, carbon sequestration and storage is hugely important for hedges. They store a lot of carbon.
Alan Moore from Hedgerows Ireland.
They have a major role in preventing and controlling flooding. They soak up a lot of water. They allow penetration of flood water into the soil. They are the home for 95% of the biodiversity on farmed land. So without hedgerows, we would have almost nothing alive in our farms.
John Hurley walks down the fields of his farm outside Clonmel to greet me. Unflappable in the midst of five dogs not happy about my arrival, he was now also looking after three Springer Collie cross pups that had just been abandoned in his yard.
Are they keepers now? Are they staying with you?
Oh, if I can find a good home for them now.
I know you're going to try and sell me one. I'm not going home with a puppy.
Just like Pat, John had a bit of a road to Damascus moment after the lifting of milk quota. The business got big and busy, and he wondered, was there another way?
I gave years, same as everyone at the moment, chasing my tail, trying to grow one blade of grass to feed two cows.
But how does the hedgerows play a part in this?
Well, we said it's all part of nature. If you can keep it back as close to nature, at the end of the day, none of us can take it with us, like we say.
The shelter provided by less manicured hedges allowed John to leave his yearlings out for the last 12 months, where many had livestock indoors for as much as 10 whole months.
We're grazing in under the wires now. You see that's grazed tight okay. There now.
And what are they looking for there?
If there's kind of herbs in there, they know themselves.
One of the more curious things John has noticed is how many of his cows graze the herbs in the hedgerows, sometimes heading there first and ignoring a fresh flush of grass.
Mm-hmm. There might be a lot of herbs there. I wouldn't know the proper, the Latin names from, but the cows will pick them up or pick them out themselves.
Are they hunting out things that they need as well?
Definitely, we say. It was some fields, we say, you leave them in, there'd be a heap of grass in it, but they'd go to the ditches first and graze around the ditches under the wire first.
They really?
Yeah, like we said, whatever herbs was in it. Like you'd often see cows grazing nettles. Like nettles are a great source of iron.
Is this a little bit too optimistic of me then to think that you can cut down your antibiotic use as well if they're grazing all these herbs?
Not one bit. Like we've cut back antibiotics a hell of a lot now in the last, 10 years.
And did you see any increase in the incidence of disease once you started cutting down on the antibiotics?
No, none at all. Okay.
I'm sure there would be those of a much more scientific and less anecdotal mind who would probably say, that's rubbish, you can't be curing your cattle from the hedgerows. But that is your experience.
Well, that's my experience, but we're living it here, we're doing it here. And we say, according to the powers that be, I'm not supposed to be viable. According to the medical people, I'm not supposed to be viable. I'm fooling them all so far. that's the way I look at it. Most sound deaf, that we say. I might look deaf, but I love what I do. To me, this is my piece of heaven.
Yeah. And how important a part of the hedgerows in that little piece of heaven?
Like, this country is known for, we say, its scenery, the beauty, like the insects and the whole lot. Like you can go over to America and you get these big prairies. We say there's no ditches and there's no nothing. We say, even somebody told me in Germany, we say they till right out to the side of the road. There's no waste. But where's the home for the insects, bats, rabbits, foxes, the whole lot?
We want to really focus on the 680,000 odd kilometres of hedgerows which remain in this country, because they're still being removed at a rate which is unsustainable.
And is it still at the rate of about 1,000 kilometres or thereabouts a year?
Well, the last figures, which I think were up to 2021, showed something like between 1,100 and 2,000 kilometres removed a year.
That's from Mallon to Mizzen, Mizzen to Mallon, and then Mallon back to Mizzen every year that's being removed.
It's a pretty frightening figure when you look at it, Philip. The other figure, though, that needs to be trotted out is that the best research shows that of the hedgerows that remain, only about a third are in good condition.
So I was getting disillusioned. So this was a real shot in the arm to me to say, actually, I have a nice place. I still have a nice farm. I can still do my farming. I can talk to other people like-minded. And between it all, we can still have a nice time. We can still have nice walks, and we can actually do some bit to the environment. We can do our bit. what I realised is how limited my bit was when I was in the biodiversity group. I couldn't do anything about water. I'm not near a river. I couldn't do anything about the bogs. I don't have one. But what I could do was I had a hedgerows. And therefore, I could say, this is my contribution to that environmental challenge. What did you do when you knew?
What did you do when you knew, indeed? The badger was looking for wasp larvae, says Shona, who has got to us through to us on the WhatsApp, 0870 32 32 32, as has Miriam Mooney, who says that that is uplifting. Listening to Pat and John as well is a person whose name comes up again and again on farms that I have visited. Wherever I've met a farmer who has decided to stop giving his hedges those repeated short back and sides, at some point, the name Catherine Keane will be mentioned. She is a Chagask advisor, preaching the gospel of hedges as habitat, and I managed to track her down during the week for a chat. Good morning, Catherine. How are you?
Good morning, Philip.
How common now are the Pats and the Johns, the farmers who are going against that short back and sides orthodox approach to hedge management?
Well, more common, Philip. There's a lot more going on hedges now at the ground. I'm actually here this morning in Ballycasseen Hotel, where I stopped off on my way to a hedgerow event on a dairy farm in Cappamore in Limerick in Garrod Mahers. So there is more going on the ground. There's also at the policy and the marketing level, there's more support for biodiversity, more interest. So I think and biodiversity is equal to water and climate at a high level. Mm. So I think both at ground and high level, there is definitely more awareness. I've been working for 30 years on biodiversity and hedges. And I would say the last three, maybe since COVID, but because of all those other policies and marketing initiatives, they are more important now.
That is really encouraging. The thing, though, when I talk to other farmers who are a bit more hesitant, the thing that stops them is the thought of the amount of land that they might lose by letting that hedge grow out. What would you say about how much land is actually lost?
Well, it's more growing up is what we want them to do. I mean, if a farmer is happy to let the hedge, we don't particularly want the hedge covering the field. That's scrub. That's a different habitat. That, you know,
what they're worried about, though, Catherine, is that a hedge grows up. It's going to block out the sun. It's going to stop the wind from clearing water off the land. Does that happen?
I presume the growth next to the hedge would be, it can be a bit different. But the shelter is enormous too, so the swings and roundabouts. So in general, no, I don't think that's a big worry for farmers.
Obviously, when the hedges grow up, they're useful as a perch to many, many species of birds. We have 110, I think, species in this country. How many of them would use hedges?
Yeah, I think they're the ones that are regularly breeding that are recorded in our Countryside Bird Survey, the Birdwatch Ireland one. Amazing, 55 of those use hedges, Philip, and 35 of them to nest, and then others use it for other reasons, you know, for feeding, for travelling along, for perching. So that's a phenomenal number, isn't it?
It is. It was exactly 50%. There seems to be two camps, Catherine. Those who say cut some hedges every year and leave others completely untouched. And then those who, like I think you heard John, or was it Pat there, saying that he would cut on a 4 or 5 year rotation. Is there a right or a wrong way to do this?
Well, there's certainly a very wrong way, Philip. And I think if people could just understand how a whitethorn grows, there are many ways and many different hedges then. But whitethorn, as we call it in the countryside, farmers call it, it's also called hawthorn, I suppose that's why we have Latin names. But when a whitethorn is planted, whether it is today or 200 years ago, as most of our hedges were, exact same as an oak tree or any other tree, its whole mission in life is to become a tree, a single stem with a big canopy full of fruit and flowers. And those hedges that have never been topped are what we call the tree line hedges. They have kind of escaped into a hedge. Now, you could actually say they're not hedges at all. They're like linear woodlands. But the huge biodiversity value, as you heard there, is in the canopy. Now, they're a bit thin at the base. but that's fine. You can't have everything everywhere. So that's what we call our tree line hedges. And we're on our Signpost Farms, we're aiming for 50% of the hedges to be tree line hedges. But there is still a place, Philip, for the topped hedge done right. And that means that you're building up the base either by, you know, building it up, pruning it from day one, building it up, or laying, indeed, or, you know, creating this really dense base, and providing that's left high enough and wide enough and occasional thorn trees are retained, you then have the benefit of the thick base and some of the canopy. So there is a place for a good topped hedge. The problem is we have upside down tallish bush hedges, which are not good topped hedges, where that tree, if you can imagine a tree, was cut in the middle, and now we've got a stump, stumpy hedges, indeed, and they're so clear in November, December.
Okay, and Catherine, thank you very much. Obviously, from what you're saying, no one-size-fits-all solution here. It's up to the individual landowner to decide what it is that works for them. Good to talk to you, Catherine Keener from Chagas. Before we move off the subject of hedges, let me just say that there is a really interesting collaboration between a farming organisation and an environmental organisation that's running at the moment. The ICMSA, the Dairy Farmers Representative Body, and Hedgerows Ireland, a group of environmental activists, are running a hedgerow photography competition. Take a picture of whatever it is about a hedge near you that has caught your eye, submit it to their expert judging panel on hedgerowsireland.org, and there is a very generous cash prize for winners who are going to be announced next month, and we will post the winners on our site too. hedgerowsireland.org for that. Sticking with changes to the way things are traditionally done, all change changed utterly on the GAA field of play this week. Tonight on RTE2 at 7:15, you can see the first matches being showcased with a plethora of new rules. New ways of throwing in, new ways of kicking out, more points for long kicks, 4 points for a goal, solo and go instead of a free kick. There is a lot for people to get their heads around here. But there is one man who thinks that the changes that we are seeing this weekend could spell the end of the world as we know it. Not the GAA, the world. It is that serious. Because you see, if the review committee has got it right, there might be an end to bad matches with annoying rules to complain about. And where would we be then? They'll have taken away your scapegoat, stolen the national lightning rod for all of our woes. Where, at that point, will all of our anger go? Liam Horan, his tongue firmly in his cheek, has his own theories.
Given that I still have my first pairs of O'Neill's togs and studded Macassar gloves, and wear them to bed whenever I get the chance, you'd think I'd be fully on board with this weekend's dramatic effort to fix the orphan child that is Gaelic football. Well, you'd be very wrong. This time, include me out. It's not that I haven't suffered with the rest of you. I too have watched the entire Donegal Championship conclude without a single score, not even in the penalty shootouts. In County Clare, groundsmen are not bothering with the goalmouths at all anymore. While in the southeast, a corner forward expired from a hypothermic episode during a junior game played on the shaded side of the Comoras. Gaelic football is, of course, the love that dare not speak its name. But if they fix it, what then? Where will all the public anger go? Modern-day Gaelic football fulfills an important but chronically undervalued role in Irish society. It is our national safety valve, our bread and circuses that soaks up the country's ire. I saw revolution die a lonely death in the souls of followers subjected to afternoons of goalkeepers clipping it back to half-forwards a full 30 yards behind them. I roared. I vowed that if the next game were played in the front lawn, I'd close the curtains. I fell silent. I fell asleep. Exactly the kind of trajectory the ruling classes desire in would-be rebels. Gaelic football does a mighty fine job of bringing the country's collective kettle almost to the boil, but not quite. Without Gaelic football to curse, attention will turn elsewhere. The health service, the roads, the single farm payment, the pent-up Gaelic football swallowed-up anger of a people shall be unloosed. By Christmas, the breakdown of law and order will be total. I fear for the worst. Jim Gavin's proposed rules are just too damn good. 4-point goals, nouveau riche, 2-pointers. The goalie stays back in his goal. Will you stay back in your goals, for God's sake? We'll win the game back and lose the country. Oh, how much they think they know, how little they truly understand.
Will someone please stop this madness? Liam Horan there. Connacht versus Ulster play the final of the Interprovincial Series this evening in Croke Park, so you get a chance to see how it works out. You can catch it on the RT News Channel and RT Player from 5:30 and RT2 and the RT Player from 7:15 this evening. Coming up after the break, the largest ever sheep sale for a single breed.
Email countrywide at rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
You're not required to use the new WhatsApp. It's not mandatory to text us on 0870 32 32 32. You can still use 51551, as Owen Murphy has this morning, to say Catherine Keane is wonderful, a super advocate for Irish biodiversity. Keep up the hard work. Did you know the largest ever sheep sale for a single breed was held recently at Mam Cross Mart in Galway? There were almost 3,000 entered by members of the Connemara Mayo Blackface Breeders Group from throughout Connemara, Mayo and Sligo. So many, it ran over 2 days. And the second day, the focus was on the rams. And Trasa Brannock went to talk to some of the farmers who were buying and selling on the day.
Right, here we go. The very highest goat, 500 again. 300.
Brendan Shuigat from the Connemara and Mayo Blackface Breeders Association. Can you tell me a little bit about the breed itself?
Yeah, the breed, I suppose, is a blackface hardened hill sheep, and I suppose it's been evolved here really in Connemara and Mayo in particular, also into the hills in Sligo. And it would be, I suppose, the main type of sheep used on the hills here in Connemara and West Mayo into Sligo. They're very hardy, very suitable for the climate, the weather conditions that we have here. And, you know, good mothers, very good mothers, again, even if lowland farmers buys them for crossbreeding as well. So they work really well as a hill sheep when they're bred pure, or again, when they're crossed to a maternal sire, they work really well as well.
And farmers from the other side of the country, Kilkenny and maybe down Wexford and that kind of side, they've seen the advantages of this breed.
Yeah, there's a good number here over the weekend, particularly yesterday with the Yowa sale here all day yesterday, and today is the ram sale. We had a lot of buyers from all over the country. We've had a lot of buyers really as well from hill areas as well on the east coast, like the Cooley Mountains down into Wicklow in particular, and a lot of Cork and Kerry areas and Donegal as well, who came here just to buy them to put on their own hills and run them pure. But we've a lot of lowland farmers who are looking to cross them, sometimes maybe with Leicesters to get mule yos out of them again. Some more are just looking to put actually terminal sires on older Connemara Mayo ewes and breed them on. So there's a lot of different buyers come here over the last 2 days. Today, I suppose, here we have over 570 rams entered. And as you can see, it's a really great turnout of stock and a lot of people here from all over the country. And in fact, the championship was won by a man from near Killarney. He's just set the record price in there for €4,050 for an aged ram in this breed. So it's great to see those buyers like Patrick O'Donovan, who has come here for many, many years buying stock rams and buying breeding ewes and indeed selling breeding ewes and now selling stock rams. So, you know, it's a wider pool than just Connemara Mayo, even though they would be known as the Connemara Mayo type of sheep, blackface sheep.
That's 340 online, 340 online, 360, 360, 390, 400.
We're selling sheep today. We come from Killarney and we've been coming since we were children with our father, who kept a flock of these in Kerry back at the start of the 80s, mid 80s should I say. So really we're just carrying on a tradition of these black sheep that we keep at home on the farm in Kerry, just a hill flock not too far from Killarney, a place called Glenflesk.
Is it unusual that you'd have the Connemara blackface down in Kerry?
No, not anymore. It maybe was a little bit unusual in the past, but looking at the minute, there's a lot more of them, of this breed of sheep appearing in Kerry over the last few years, and more so in the last couple of years.
And congratulations, you set the record price here for a ram, was it?
A ram that we bought here 3 years ago up here in Galway, and actually by a Mayo man that bred him here. He was Kevin Mourne, was his name, and we bought him as a year old, and we have sold him today at 4 years old, and he set a record price here in the mart here in Mamscross today.
Top of the house, 460. One more try. I'll take 70 of you. Any good to you? 20, 40, 60.
Are you buying or selling today?
Doing a bit of both, yeah. Trying to sell. Sold one. The other one I didn't sell. And I'm hoping to buy a ram as well.
Can you explain to me what a nice ram is? What are people looking for?
One of the most important things about a ram is his mouth, his teeth. In other words, that the teeth are not sticking out over his gum. And the sheep that come out of that ram then would have the same problem, you know, and they'd have a difficulty grazing, if you understand. So that's one of the main. The other thing is not to have a too high a shoulder. Nice looking ram like that there now.
Roisin O'Brien, you're a farmer here from Clonbur. Can you tell me a little bit about your own farm and the type of farming you do?
Yeah, so we're a hill farm. We run organic stock. It's nothing huge. It's mostly just me and my dad.
And is it all sheep you have?
Yeah, all sheep. Well, yeah, we used to have cattle years ago, but no, I'm definitely a sheep person now.
Why did you come today? And what are you hoping to buy, or are you hoping to sell?
We're hoping to buy. So maybe one or two rams we definitely need this year. And I suppose the SIS, the new scheme, there's a lot more interest. So the department have this scheme where you need to have a SIS ram. It has to be approved. So there's a good few here today. So that's definitely helping, I think, with trade.
And you've been here now for a while. The sale has been happening since. You know what the prices are. Are you happy with the prices here today?
Oh, trade is good, yeah, definitely. You can definitely see the SIS rams are going a little bit more. There's a little bit more interest. So I think it's helping trade.
You're a young farmer, Roisin.
Yeah.
It's nice to see young farmers here as well today, isn't it?
Yeah, there's definitely an interest, I think. People say it's dying out, but I don't think so. There's plenty generations in here. Yeah.
On top. All down. Thank you, but what else? 880.
Furious trading there. Trasad Ronick at the Connemara Mayo Black Sheep Mart in Mam Cross. Ron Beamster texts on 51551. One major threat to Whitethorn is fire blight, which is spreading at an alarming rate. Can you mention that sometime? Excuse me. Yes, indeed, you can. Myself and Catherine were actually talking about that, and we decided to dedicate a report to it in the coming weeks at some stage. On Thursday, the National Organic Awards were held in association with the Department of Agriculture. There's a total of 7 awards that were presented to organic growers and food producers, including the New and Innovative Award, which went to Gary Hinch Wood Exotic Mushrooms from Offaly. Now, Brenda Donoghue loves nothing more than a winner, and you're going to think that I'm exaggerating here, but I'm not. No word of a lie. She actually laid in wait outside Bord Bia's offices in Dublin to find out who the winners were. And then she stalked Joe Gorman and his wife Dolores all the way back to Gary Hinch on the banks of the River Barrow.
Joe, it must be you. How are
it is,
you?
Brenda, yeah. You're welcome to Gary Hinch on such a lovely evening.
It's gorgeous, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Congratulations on your award.
Thanks very much.
What does it mean?
I mean, we've been at awards before, but never come home with anything. So it was a big deal for us. Like, we're a small company and we're new in this business. Yeah, very nice to get the award.
It's nice to bring a trophy home to Offaly, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Yeah, any day. We're going into tunnel number 10, Brenda,
yeah.
And it's shiitake.
Right. I'm not going to risk saying the word. Will you describe the mushrooms, please?
So this is a shiitake mushroom. They're Japanese origin.
Yeah.
Would be probably the biggest part of our business is the shiitake. It'd be the best known, I'd say, in the market.
Talk me through your shiitake. See, I got it there.
Are you good?
Yeah, there you go. Rows of it as far as the eye can see, but it's what they're in.
Yeah,
I think that's really interesting in terms of the organic nature of your product.
So what they're growing on, Brenda, is wood-based substrate, which is a beech sawdust. So this is next week's crop, and we're just removing the plastic as it goes. Like, it's obviously to allow the mushroom to grow out. There's a microclimate in the bag that helps it to develop. So you have the condensation and all. You also have a filter on the front of the bag that allows out the gases. And everything just is very neat there, and it'll start to pin.
Joe, we'll go to another tunnel, but while we're walking and talking, tell me a little bit about yourself and your wife and how you got set up here. Why mushrooms, first of all?
Initially, I was a family of 12, and there was 5 girls and 7 boys, and we were reared on a farm just up the road from here. It was a mixed farm, so there was no way I was in for the shake-up when it came to farming. Like, I was the last of 7 lads.
Yeah.
There was a good shake for me. I was always looking around for something. I was taking Conacre initially, and I reared sheep and sugar beet. Like the idea of working outdoors and working on your own, you know, that's your own initiative. It was supposed to be something that's instilled from me, from parents, you know, when we were growing up. Like there was never, even Sunday, was never really a day off. Some people had to turn them off, but we actually enjoyed it. Was in 88, Brenda, there wasn't much out there, so basically I was looking around for an enterprise that I could manage myself, and mushrooms seemed like a good fit. The English market was opening up for mushrooms, and the Irish industry was starting to, you know, supply into the UK, and it was by mid-90s they owned it, 50% of the retail business in the UK, and to this day they still own 50% of the retail business in the UK. We could see there was headroom in the industry, like, to keep going. So that was the main driver behind it.
You're taking me into Polytunnel 9.
Yeah.
So buckle in, everybody.
Yeah. So here we have White Beech and, or Shimenji, they call them in Japanese name. We actually have a mixed pack in Dunstores with those of White Beech and Shiitake. And that's actually the one we won the prize for. Ali, will you bring those pallets around the back there? I want to load them with product.
All right, Joe.
You were on the white buttons, you had a good business going over to the UK. What happened then?
Brexit happened then, and we were in contracts like at 83 pence sterling, and the morning after the vote, sterling went to 95. So automatically, like, our margin and was completely wiped out. We were losing money from that point on, so we had to, in 2 months, we had to wind up the old operation. So we had 30 people employed at that stage. Also, like, it was a big shock. We had a massive investment here, and we just literally had to turn the key in it and walk away. The overwhelming thing was the shock of getting up in the morning and not having anywhere to go. And I mean, I'd spent my life at Mushroom, so I wasn't trained in any other aspect. Yeah, it was a massive shock to the system.
We're going into Polytunnel 7. We're skipping 1 or 2. Yeah. What have we in here?
There's grey and yellow oysters.
So, Joe, there you were, Brexit, business on the floor. You had to rethink. Where'd the whole exotic mushroom idea come from?
Well, I suppose being involved in mushrooms, Brenda, over the years, we'd been at shows in Holland, and I always supplied a certain amount of product into the Dublin market. I went over to Holland to research it. I knew it was the only option, you know, because there was nothing else that'd grow in these tunnels because they're too dark. I then decided to do a course on them in Holland and hooked up with a few growers, like, that went around their farms and seen how they run their business. And yeah, I thought there was a good chance maybe this would work.
Polytunnel number four.
Number four, yeah. And
okay.
Here we have Lion's Mane.
Oh, wow. How do they get it to look like it's like a beard, white beard?
Well, that's where it gets its name. It's Lion's Mane. So it looks like the mane off of a lion. In food service, like, it would be treated as a steak. So you would cook it like a steak.
When you go home for tea, would you ever cook the mushrooms?
I would. Well, there's never a day I'd say we wouldn't eat mushrooms. I like mushrooms. If I went out for a meal now and there was garlic mushrooms on the menu, I'd have them. No matter how much hardship I got at them, I'd still eat them. Mushrooms, to me, are infectious. I mean, I've spent 35 years now at this stage growing them, and, you know, you never get tired of it. A day like today is a hugely significant day because, I mean, to be acknowledged at a national level for what you do, you can stick it in your collar and perk up a bit.
Joe Gorman there. I think Brenda Donoghue deserves one of those broadcasting award thingies. Exotics from Amsterdam all throughout that report, and she didn't even giggle or snigger once. Now, there is a man sitting opposite me in the studio for pretty much all of this morning's programme who has a guitar. I asked him to leave, but he didn't. So I'm not going to introduce him by name. I'm going to let the music do that. Here's a bit of the current single, which you might have heard. Good morning, Porrick Jack. How are you?
Morning, Philip. I'm good. And yourself?
I love that song. That is a perfect Saturday morning song, isn't
it? Thanks very much. Yeah, it's a bit happier than some of the other ones.
This is what the critics are saying about the second album, These Shores. They love your seamless bilingualism. That sounds a bit fruity, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But you write in Irish and English. How do you decide whether a song needs to be written in Irish or in English?
I let the song guide me on that one. Some songs feel more natural if they come to me in one language or the other. I tend to go with that. Or maybe decide later on if it warrants working on translating.
You grew up in Inishmore. I take it that the house was bilingual, was it?
It was indeed, yeah, yeah. Yeah, my dad is fluent. He's from the island. My mother's from Connemara, English-speaking part of Connemara, but yeah.
Okay, and one spoke English to you throughout your childhood and the other spoke Irish.
Something like that, yeah. And Irish was all around us as well, you know.
But then, I mean, when you're being inspired by the landscape or where it is that you live, what is it that decides whether it will be Irish or English?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess certain songs that might have a certain theme or feeling in the song might just feel more natural to sing it in Irish.
And have you started a song in one language and said, no, this is wrong, and gone to the other
one? Yeah, I kind of have, yeah, yeah. Yeah, because maybe I don't have the vocabulary maybe in Irish to make certain songs work maybe in that language. So,
okay.
Yeah.
As I said, Inishmore, you're not going to be making it back to the island this week with Storm Ashley.
No, I was to go home now, but I need to be in Galway Monday morning. So I think I might skip it maybe because there's one or two storms, I think, coming. So, yeah.
You're commuting backwards and forwards from Oranmore to the island
because
Dad and Mum run Joe Waddy's pub.
They do indeed, yeah, yeah.
What was it like growing up there?
It was a great place to grow up. I think, I mean, when you're young, you obviously miss the amenities of a bigger town, like anyone in a rural place. But
I was going to say now, the winters must have been a bit lonely and hard, as great as the summers were.
They were, and we didn't have quite as big boats as we have now. Although we did have the plane all my life, but so you could always get in and out most of the time. But yeah, the winters are a bit dour. It's not like the summer. People say, oh, I'd love to live here. It's like, yeah, winter is a little bit different. But
how much of a role does Inishmore play in your music?
Oh, I think a big part, yeah, like the title track of my first album is about the Aran and, you know, the landscape and the history and culture of the place. And the language, I think, is a big part of it as well. So I think that just seeps into the music, the words and music all the time.
You can drop in and out of Shan Nose as well, can you?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I would have grown up singing Shan Nose when I was in school, national school. And
would you mind?
Sure, I'll do a line of Oran Wiense song, Connemara song. Scovain tri lege warege nu eslev che wadohi.
Jesus, hairs on the back of my neck. That just transports you instantaneously, doesn't it? So talk to me a little bit about the backstory to the song that you're going to sing for us now.
Yeah, I'm going to sing a song called Lovely Stare. I wrote it about my partner, Kira, who I met in Berlin 10 years ago. I was over playing music with a few friends. We went over. We knew one guy there, and she was his housemate who just lived there. And I met her there, and I thought she was German, like, because she looked, when I met her, because she was in college there and stuff, and speaking German. And I said, "Oh, you sound kind of Irish." She goes, "Oh, I grew up in Galway." I was like, "All right." And then after a while later, I was like, "You know, I know you're from Galway, but you look kind of German." She was like, "Yeah, well, both my parents are German." So,
and who was doing the steering? You or her?
Oh, that was her. I just remember I was singing, I was playing a show, and she was. I remember. We both were, actually, now that I think about it. I was probably, yeah, she might have caught me staring as well.
If you get on and off the islands or don't go to the islands, you're going to be back over this side of the country next Friday, is it?
Indeed, yeah, next Friday night, yeah, in the Unitarian Church just on Stephen's Green there. I'm playing a show as part of my current tour, and I'll be there on Friday night. And there are a few tickets left.
Okay.
Not a whole lot, but yeah.
All right, well, up you hop there and get over and pick up that guitar, which hopefully hasn't, under the studio lights, ended up going out of tune. That is all that we have time for on the programme this week, as the man from Inishmore is going to play us out now. Liam Mullen had to be stopped throwing bits of Dunangus off the cliff. Amandine Paso Devine lay down on her tummy to look over the edge, and Brenda Donoghue shouted, "Get back!" at least 100 times. Thank you for listening. Sinead Egan is up next with Playback. But now, playing us out this morning, Porrick Jack with Lovely Stair from his album These Shores.
I was lost in a young man's wasteland, happiness a memory. I took a trip away with 4 fine men. We set out for Germany, where an Irish girl of another world who reminded me of Grace. Together she and I, we do laugh and cry. We'll have one day a family. And when I smile as an old and happy man by a fire in a rocking chair, it'll be for a life spent with the girl with the lovely, graceful stare.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.